Roadrunners International Reunion, October 7th, 2009, interview with A12 Mission Planners, Sam Pizzo, Al Rossetti, and Harold Mills, conducted by Mary Pilevsky, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the NTS Oral History Project. Please note comment from Fred White of Lockheed at end of interview, recorded in collaboration with and at the Atomic Testing Museum, Las Vegas, Nevada.
Okay, so
thank you for joining me this afternoon. We're going to be discussing mission support group and mission planning for the A-12 program. And with introductions, we begin.
My name's Al Rossetti. I came to Area 51 in late 1963 from a B-47 bomber wing, and I was there until just before the closure of the site or our outfit in 1968. And I was in mission planning for the entire time.
Okay.
My name's Sam Pizzo, and I was one of the initial mission planners arriving in 1961, and I left there in 1965. So what we went through was the verification of all the data that Lockheed had provided us as to how the aircraft would perform. We planned missions to prove that, which it did. And I left there in 65 to go on the SR-71 recon program.
Okay.
My name is Harold Mills. I don't really know why I was assigned there. I was a photo interpreter in the Air Force. I was the only photo interpreter assigned. And I was assigned to the flight planning section. I guess for some reason they thought we might be looking at pictures, but we never did. I went there in 1961 from 11th Bomb Wing in Altus, Oklahoma, and I left in 1966 for an assignment in Germany.
Okay. Okay, so I thought I would start with just some background history. I'll ask you, Sam, and then the others can come in. And as we said, one of the rules is to wait till the other person's finished before you jump in, and I have to remember to do that too. From what I understand from reading your book, when you arrived there, that was the beginning of this phase of the program. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So tell me a little bit about that, why this began at this time.
When I was selected for the program after being interviewed at CIA headquarters and being accepted, I did not have any idea of what I was being accepted for. Mm-hmm. And it was only until we went up to the ranch and found out that we'd be working with the A-12 program. And we still, at that point, did not know exactly what we would be doing because we did not have any information yet from Lockheed. We eventually got information on mission planning and what we were supposed to do, and people like Al and Harold and others started coming in, and we just assigned different responsibilities to different people, and the way it was flowing in on us, they got the job and they had to do it, and they did. Mm-hmm. So we verified everything that Lockheed said the airplane would do. We planned the missions. We coordinated with the tankers. We implemented procedures to take pictures of the map to put in the cockpit. And after every mission, we interviewed with the pilots and updated and changed constantly. I guess that lasted for a period of about a year or two before I think it settled in, and we had, in my opinion, an operational squadron just like any other Air Force unit. But it took little time for that to take place. And a lot of changes working with Lockheed and the pilots to make that come about.
I mean, how unusual is this within the armed forces to be doing this mission planning with a with a plane, with an instrument that's basically untested and new.
We were used to flying an aircraft about 600 miles an hour at about 40,000 feet. When you went in the mission plan, it's something that others had done before you. And so it was a routine, a very simple routine to follow what was there before. In our case, we did not know what to expect for mission planning because of the difference in the pilot's capability to see in the aircraft we all came from. We had radar. They had none. It was eyeballs. So whatever we planned had to be worked around the pilot's capability to be able to view in the cockpit what we made for him and verify it with viewfinders from atomic, veratomic. So it was a coordinated effort between tech reps, pilots, and mission planners, which took a little time and effort. And after a couple of missions, you found out what the pilots could or could not see. When we started out, we thought you could see this on the ground to verify position. It was not the case. The initial navigation system that was in the bird was an INS, inertial navigation system, and it was very good. You set latitude and longitudes, and it went where it was supposed to go. So it was just a matter of validate, test, verify, work together. And I would say that all the people we had there, we initially started off with 7 navigators, 3 enlisted, and 1 tech rep. And I would say that 99% of it, we all did things as way outside of what we were supposed to do.
Yeah.
And nobody complained, and I think we benefited from that. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, I think it worked out well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Al, tell me a little bit about where you had come from and what you were doing when you first arrived.
All right, I was flying, I was radar navigator in a B-47 at Plattsburgh Air Force Base in New York. And like Sam, we were discussing earlier why did each of us come there? And we all had different, different histories or different stories. And mine was, I happened to be, I got there and I was flying with a crew, and somehow or another the pilot and I, this is a little out of school type thing, but the pilot got drunk when we were over in England, and I flew back with a drunk pilot. And I said I'd never fly with that guy again. So then I flew with another crew, and they put me on with a young pilot. This was his first crew, and he was probably one of the best pilots I ever flew with, and I really enjoyed it. We were doing extremely well, and he got sent off to squadron officer school. They broke up our crew, and after that, I sort of got bounced around. Well, apparently a message came from headquarters. They needed a navigator, and I think because I was the navigator that was bouncing around to different crews because they needed me here, there, and everywhere, I sort of got selected. All of a sudden, I get this message comes in, and I'm to report to Washington. And as I was telling the story to Sam just a little while earlier, I get this thing, and the directions are, go to Washington, D.C., call this number, and ask for Major Blood. Now, actually, Major Blood existed, but when you get something that says call Major Blood at this number, you sort of wonder. So I went there, and I thought, okay, I call this number, and I talked to whoever answered the phone. I says, I'd like to speak to Major Blood. This is Captain Rossetti. And Major Blood's on leave, which he was. And but come to this, take a taxi cab and go to this address. So I go out to the taxi cab driver and I said, I'd like to go to such and such. I was completely in the dark. He says, oh, you want to go to CIA building? And so I did. They gave me an interview that day, said the next day I had to go to CIA headquarters. They gave me where they put you on the chair and they ask you questions and you got to tell the truth. And I had interviews, and I think we all did, with psychiatrists and all that. And they said, thank you very much. And I don't know whether they told me I was accepted at that time or not. Mm-hmm. The reason I got out to here in Las Vegas was my understanding, I'm talking to people later, that Sam was promised the first new individual that they okayed to come out to go, because some people went to Washington, some people came here, was his. And so just by luck, I happened to be the first one that was okay to come into the program, and he got me. And you know, and when I got out here, it was the same thing. Call Major Pizzo, because I didn't know what he was going to do out here. Call Major Pizzo with this number, and they'll tell you what to do. And it wasn't until he told me, well, take some time, go get housing for your family, and which I did. I guess he gave me about a week or so. And then he said, called me up, he said, you find housing? I said, yeah, I did. I got an apartment right behind the Sahara Hotel, and which was very nice and convenient to the Strip. And he says, pick me up at 5 o'clock in the morning or some ridiculous hour. And I picked him up at his house, and we drove up to the test site, and I had to get a badge when we entered the site, and I had to get a badge when we entered the area. And then he, one of the 130 navigators there, he said, Howie, go show him what we got out in the back hangar, because there was nothing out that you could see. And that was the first time when the major that he asked to take me out, that was the first time I saw the airplane and had any idea what I was going to do. And from there on, it was I worked for him, and the first thing he did, or one of the first things he did, was introduce me to, at that time, Sergeant Mills, and he said, Sergeant Mills will show you what to do. And Sergeant Mills spent maybe got a few of his gray hairs there, showed me what to do, and it was probably the best 5 years that I spent in the Air Force. It was the most interesting. I felt it was the most satisfying. Anything else you need to know?
No, that's great.
That's great.
For intro.
Okay.
Intro. Well, but now to Sergeant Mills. What kinds of things were you asked to show him?
Oh, I just had to teach him how to navigate.
Well, thank you, sir.
No, really, it didn't require all that much showing. The flight planning for an airplane that's going to travel in excess of Mach 2 up in the Mach 3 range all the time requires a different set of rules from an airplane that's flying down lower and at lower speeds. And especially when that airplane is limited in the bank angle that it can attain. Mm-hmm. If it banked very steeply into a turn, then there was always danger for the inside engine having what they call an unstart on that particular engine. Mm-hmm. So it had to go very shallow bank angles, which meant very wide sweeping turns. And that's the main thing. You had to indoctrinate guys who had been flying a little bit slower airplanes, not slow airplanes, but a little bit slower airplanes, and at a little bit lower altitudes, had to adjust to the idea that this thing took an 85-mile turn radius, mm-hmm. and that the pilot could not see out closer than 15 miles on each side of the airplane because of the chines on it. So that's where the periscope. There was people see the big scope in the pictures of the thing, mm-hmm. and the cockpit, and that was not a radar, that was a periscope. It was like one used in a submarine that Mr. Goodwin's company built, and you could look in the periscope and see straight down what was straight down under the airplane. And that was our mission planning objective, was to lay out a line that was going to be right in the middle of that periscope when he looked at it and recognize the things on the ground. Why I wound up doing it, I can't tell you.
Now, that was going to be my sort of retroactive question, which was, how had you come to that?
I think the big reason that I was selected is I had been in two other projects before this one, very highly classified projects, and they both required very deep background investigations. And when they do a deep background investigation, it could cost $20,000 to $25,000 just tracking down people where you used to live and old places you used to work and find out if you have ever advocated the overthrow of the United States government or have done anything else disloyal. So I had been through all that. And in my little book, I mentioned that because I had had a deep background investigation, I was kind of like a prepaid prostitute. I was available at no extra money. And so that's the reason I'm sure that I went. I had to go up and get the interview and the lie detector like Al did and all of that. But it was pretty. When I went back to my bomb wing in Oklahoma, I had no idea where or when I'd be going. Uh-huh. And one day some very excited young second lieutenant from personnel called me up and said, "We have a set of secret orders here for you." And he had never seen a set of secret orders in his life. And I said, "No kidding." And first thing I know, we're on our way to Las Vegas. And we got a house and out what was then a brand new housing development called College Park, where there was no college and no park. And a whole lot of the other guys up there were living in the same area, so it made it convenient for carpooling. You know, we always carpool back and forth. But as far as the mission planning, I was fortunate in that I had been a commercial pilot in civilian life, so I knew a little something about. I had seen aeronautical charts and that sort of thing before, you know, so I knew a little something about that. And I'd also been involved in some sneaky photo missions overseas and things like that. So it was just a question of upgrading to mm-hmm. the altitudes and speeds that we were going to be dealing with.
Okay, so for someone who, this is not the field that I have a lot of expertise in, so I need to understand something about the mission planning. On your notes here, Sam, you have verified aircraft data forwarded from Lockheed, but are these are not test flights that you're working on. They are both the test flights and something more. Okay, so you get my drift, what I'm trying to ask here.
Well, first off, there were no test flights.
All right.
When the airplane was put in boxes in parts and brought to the area, it was assembled. And I think there was two test pilots. I think it was Bill Parks and Lou Shaw.
And say the second name?
Lou Shaw.
He was from Virginia.
And, okay.
And what they did was, when the plane was assembled, this was the two-seaters. Okay? Mm-hmm. They flew the airplane and it performed. Okay, but this was not at the high altitude and so forth. They just wanted to be sure it flew. So the test was conducted at the area, and as soon as they were declared it test worthy, we had two Air Force pilots, major then, Ray Hopp and Harold Bergeson mm-hmm. were checked out in it, and they in turn were going to check out the project pilots. So basically it was, here's an airplane, does it fly? Yes. Okay, start flying it.
All right.
And so that's the way it worked. And at the same time, they gave us performance figures that they thought would to be accomplished, and we had to start checking on that. Every time we planned a mission, we planned short. Mm-hmm. If we were gonna, they said we could go for 1,500 miles before refueling. We went for 1,100 or 1,200 miles and gradually increased that as we found out that the figures that Lockheed presented us were good or bad or whatever. So we had to just verify what Lockheed said it would do. And also doing that, we had to work with the tanker squadrons because the tankers had to be modified to carry the special fuel that was involved. And so we worked closely with the tankers also. Every time we flew a mission, we had refueling. That was mandatory.
Now, to back up a little bit, if something doesn't check out with the way Lockheed says it will, what happens there? Do you have to figure out what it is, if it's a big thing or a little thing? And
I'm going to throw this one open to these two for a yes or no.
Okay.
I do not recall anything that Lockheed said the airplane would do, and it did not do.
That's true.
For the most part, yeah. We would, as Sam said, we would start out, we had a route called Wells. Now, Wells is, Harold, 500 miles north of here, if they're not even that, 250, 300
like
miles?
That, yeah.
Okay. That was one of the first routes, and that's all we did. We flew from here. We would fly, and I remember we flew up to a VOR north of here, which was current VOR, and then we would go up to Wells, which I believe was a VOR too, that we turned on and came back. And then after that, we had a what was called Twin Falls, which was up to what, Idaho, Twin Falls?
Yes.
And we would fly that route, which was, I don't know, maybe 1,000 miles up or something like that, Harold?
1,200 miles.
1,200 miles, okay.
Exactly.
And that was we would go up and we would fly these routes. Now, we had another individual at the time, Major Corbin, who was doing the fuel monitoring. And what he would do, we would take the fuel that we used on this route, and he would work backwards, you know, okay, we got so many miles to the gallon, or thousands of gallons, actually. And, and then we would say, okay, the airplane, as Sam said, we would go a little farther, a little farther, a little farther. And the pilots were learning, too. We had a pilot, and I believe he was a Marine. He was the only Marine pilot we had, and I briefed him one day. And he was going to fly the Twin Falls route. You don't quite remember this, probably not. And he went up, and he was supposed to turn the camera on. We were doing checking how the equipment worked, you know, all the equipment. And he came down, and I said to him, I can't remember his first name. I know his name is listed someplace. I happened to see it recently. And he came down, and he says, I'm never going to do it again. He says the airplane was too much for me. Because I briefed him prior to the mission, and I briefed him afterwards. And I really admired for him for it afterwards because, here he was in a special project, and God, we all felt good about having been selected for this project. And the airplane was, it was a job to handle. It was something new. It was like us. We were doing something new, and he was doing something new, and he couldn't handle the airplane, so he never did the other stuff. Well, that leads back to what did we have to do? We had to provide everything the pilot needed that we could possibly provide so that he could concentrate on flying the airplane. That the less he had to do outside of flying that airplane, the better it was, because then we could have a successful mission. And that was, as we learned. We learned what he needed. We learned what we had to do. We experimented. I was telling a story earlier, and again, Sam, getting older, we all are, aren't we? He called me, and before all this happened, Sam called all of us and asked for assistance. And I said, Sam, I said, maybe one of the things, I said, how about the control panel that I had come up with, the idea that I had come up with? He says, what are you talking about? Well, we had two different, at that time, we were supposed to have four, I believe it was. We ended up with two different camera companies, Eastman Kodak and Bell. Eastman Kodak and what?
Icon.
Huh?
Icon.
Yeah, Perk and Elmer. And Perk and Elmer had a preheat position for their equipment. You had to turn it to preheat, then you had to turn it to heat, then you had to turn it to operate. One of the things that Perk and Elmer's camera also did was, supposedly was going to do, you could take pictures straight down, you could take them on the left oblique, on the right oblique, or any combination of these. Eastman Kodak, I think their camera only worked in the one position. Well, we had different, the pilots would get in the airplane, and every time they had a different camera package, they would have to put in a different control panel. So I asked Sam, he was my boss, and this is one of the things we were talking about earlier. We were allowed to do different things, and he was a great boss in that he allowed us to do it. If we had an idea, he'd say, go to it. Well, I said, Sam, you know, I've been noticing as I'm briefing the pilots, I got to tell them preheat position, this and the other thing. I says, maybe, can I go down and talk to the tech reps for the two cameras and see if we can come up with something? So he said, sure, go down. And I went down, and I talking to the tech reps, and I says, look, I says, I'd like a little box, control box, about yay big. I says, and what I want is, I want a wafer switch. The wafer switch has to go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and three position being straight up, and, you know, the others off. I says, it's got to fit in where the control panel is. I said, I don't care what you people do inside. All I want that control panel to do is be 0 off. I want it to be 1 and 2 preheat positions if you need them. Otherwise, gang bar it to just nothing. I want the 3 straight up and down to be the normal operate position. And then for Perk and Elmer, 4, 5, and 6, if you want to use alternate settings. I went down there, I came back after I'd been down there, I don't know, an hour or so. And I came back, I told Sam, I talked to him. 2 days later, I think it was, or maybe even the next day, the Eastman Kodak people, one of the tech reps came up and says, is this what you want? And I look at it, and I said, oh, that's great. When can we use it? And they said, well, you know, we got to, this is just a mock-up. We got to do this, that, and the other thing. And he says, we got to put edge lighting on it, and we've got to do this to it. He says, and we got to test it for, you know, running. Is it going to catch on fire, that type of thing. And I guess it was a month later or so that they came in. I also showed it to Sam because I had to get his approval, you know, and he says, go with it. And I guess a month later they had run through all the things, and out comes this little package. And I talking again to the Eastman Kodak guy, he says, what's this going to cost us? He says, take a guess. I says, well, you probably got $100 worth of equipment in it. I said, but you'll sell it to us for $1,000. And he says, $10,000 each. And I mean, I don't know if that was just an off-the-cuff amount that he gave. And I don't know what we paid for it. But he said, we had engineers that would go in, they set it up, you know, running current through it. And they'd have an engineer, he said, we have to go have an engineer go in there every hour and write down the temperatures and what have you and all that. But anyway, that's what we used. And we used that control panel for the entire program. And I always felt that if I contributed nothing else, I contributed that control panel. And
well, that's a great example, because I was going to ask you for an example of something that you worked out to make things easier for the pilots.
That's what we did. I mean, if something came up.
And that's an example of it.
If something came up, we had to improvise.
Yes.
I think the key to all of this is the fact that the interaction between the pilots, Lockheed, and the mission planners, mm-hmm. and others too, and I can really speak for us. Once the pilot had the general briefing, you will take off at 10 o'clock in the morning, stations at such and such a time, mm-hmm. the pilot came back to our section where we had a very small room where we briefed the pilot on a one-to-one basis. We took that film strip, it was in a projector, we sat in this little room, one-on-one, went through the routes for him and so forth. When the mission was over, we had the same kind of situation in reverse.
Yes.
Did you find what we said worked? Did it did not work? What do you recommend that we do different? For instance, we used to put stamps on a map. We were used to doing it the way we flew. That these little stamps in time, distance to go, latitude, longitude, a whole bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. a little rubber stamp, boom. And you'd fill them out, and that would be photographed.
Yes.
Well, you talked about, is this sufficient? Is this too much, too little? I saw a copy of a map just recently of how it ended up. Didn't look like anything that we started off with. But that was the whole theme of Oxcart.
Yes.
It was get something in, verify it, improve it, and go with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it worked to perfection, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's a really great summary of it. But you must have had, before I pose my next sort of general topic, did you want to add anything to that, Harold?
No.
What you just said?
No. We were probably a little more closely associated with what went on minute by minute, hour daily with the pilots, one thing, another thing. You might get the impression we knew these guys. We knew them really well. They would come in and they'd shoot the bull with us. You know, we knew what they were thinking. We knew what they were capable of. Generally speaking, what they were capable of. And they were having an experience that they had never had before. They were flying at speeds practically unheard of before people started, before a few select test pilots flew rocket planes. They were, and they found that the maps that they used to use when they were flying F-100s and they wanted to see a map at a scale of 1 to 500,000, they go on and off of that map at a period of 10 minutes, you know, and birds they were flying with us. And they had to readjust their thinking, and we had to help them with that, and we had to kind of guide them.
Yeah. Now that it's very, very interesting because you're talking about a way someone's being trained, and it's the next step in the training. But it's a huge leap.
They were all enthusiastic.
Uh-huh.
When they would bring a new group in there, and it was the favorite way to do it was to take them down to the hangar line, and there was a door opened in the hangar. And you step in, you'd be right next to the nose of this ungodly airplane, black, long nose, and two huge nacelles. These were big engines. And occasionally, one would step back out of the door and say, I'll be damned if I'll fly that airplane. And they'd get on the bird and go home. There was never anything derogatory in their record. They just would choose not to fly that airplane. It was strictly voluntary. Everything was strictly voluntary. Mm-hmm. And some of them would look at it and couldn't wait to get in it. You know? Mm-hmm. So it was just, that was the guys we were looking for. Mm-hmm.
I think that the sense of what you're hearing here is that there wasn't a sense of, this is my section and I will run it, and this is his section, he will run it, and so forth. That didn't exist. It was one section, mm-hmm. and we all participated. Mm-hmm. And I don't care, he was a sergeant. Bill Goodwin was a civilian. Mm-hmm. We were Air Force. That had absolutely nothing to do with it. We worked as a unit. And I think if it hadn't been that, you wouldn't have had a successful A-12.
Well, I think what's interesting about it, sort of from the history of technology, is that you are really talking, you're on the edge of, you know, applied science, you know, very high levels of engineering and technology, mm-hmm. so that the model that's used in science, of course, is very collaborative, and idea of rank or property or territory you just can't have it, because if that information doesn't get across the line, say to the pilot or to whomever it needs to get to, back to the to Lockheed or whatever, you're going to have a catastrophic failure. So the idea that there has to be this kind of collaboration is very reminiscent of what you hear a lot in histories of, you know, very high levels of science and technology, because you need that experiential feedback immediately, right?
Well, if you didn't get it, you could put a pilot's life at risk.
Right.
And I don't think any of us ever thought, at least in my mind, I never thought that we would not come up with the right answers at the right time. Mm-hmm. But I also felt that I didn't think I had one person there who knew everything.
Right.
It took all seven of us.
Right.
And I think the pilots appreciated that too, because I think the participation by the pilots in their efforts of what we were doing, they realized it was for their benefit.
Right.
And they were most willing to sit with us, and unlike a lot of other units, it was a close-knit group. It truly was.
Well, I mean, it's clear just from the half hour we've been talking that your leadership had a lot to do with the success of this. So having said that, you talk about some of them in your book, and I haven't had a chance to read your book, Harold, since I just bought it. But I remember some stories in your book about things that needed to be developed. The one that comes to mind is the map that has to be not readable should anything bad happen, the black ink. But if you can each give me an example of some kind of technology that you needed to, or I don't know if we call it technology, some kind of invention that had to go into this airplane that was different than what had been seen before, for whatever reason.
I don't think I can give you a technical example, because what I was responsible for was not technical. It was, in a sense, but not really technical, because if we saw that there were, the fuel consumption wasn't being matched by what Lockheed said, our answer was to tell Lockheed
to fix it.
That it was not. We weren't a corrective type organization. We were an investigative type organization who provided information that may lead, as he said, about the switch. So we were relying upon what we had brought to the table, mission planning capabilities, but upped it to the higher speeds and altitudes and flight performance of the A-12. So we did not participate in any, to my knowledge, big things.
Well, no, then you're very intelligently critiquing my question, so let me rephrase it. From the mission planning and investigative point of view, you gave one example, but other kinds of examples of things that needed to be different in that aircraft that you then gave feedback for to have be developed, like you have an example.
Well, I was gonna add, when I got there, when I flew B-47s, you took a JN chart and you laid the route on and you put the information, and you just sort of, it was there, and you maybe cut it up so that you could manipulate it in the small confines of a B-47. And when I got there, they had already started doing this. What they did is you took the mission and you laid it out. And then on the turns, they actually had, I don't know who came up with it, but somebody ended up with a big piece of plastic about yay long, and there were etch marks on it, and it was like a template you put on the map that orientated towards the in the direction of flight, and we cut the maps, and you cut them into sections. Now, they were doing this before me. And then, in turn, we orientated all the information on the map. When we were doing it initially, you just orientated north-south or whatever, you know, it was convenient. But here, because we were going to make a film strip, and the pilots, again, they weren't going to use a map. They had to have this film strip. We orientated it so the pilot always was going this way, or the route showed up, down, up, down. And we put all the information orientated to the direction of flight. And then in turn, we took photographs of this. Harold's and others worked on this section. We took photograph, 35 millimeter photograph, and we made a film strip, as Sam was talking about earlier. This went in the airplane, and it was also another innovation that had to be done is when we were going to go operational, if this airplane was going to be bailed out of or was going to crash, we wanted to destroy that. We didn't want the same thing to happen that happened over Russia, where they ended up with the maps. So I forget what they actually had, but the film would burn up. As far as Harold showed a piece of map that we put on little wooden frames that were hollow, that were just frames, and what we had was we had material, we drove an extra set of maps and on water-soluble paper. And this water-soluble paper supposedly was going to, water was going to rush into this container next to the pilot, and it was going to, we were going to end up with goo. Mm-hmm. And but these are the things, these weren't done before, that I'm aware of anyway. We were using the same maps that we used on a B-47, JN chart, but we were making film strips out of it. The pilot never had a map in his hand. Mm-hmm. He had a film strip that was loaded into Bill's build system, and he would look through the viewfinder to see. And all the information we had to provide him. He didn't have what we call, and Sam remembers as an E6B, I remember as an E10, little handheld calculator. Calculator was, you know, one of these twist things. Sort of a circular slide rule, yes, is basically what it was. And we had to be innovative, and we changed these. We changed what the information and everything we put on this as it was needed, as we talked between the pilots, etc. And another quick thing is, when Sam says it was one shop, if I wasn't doing anything in my shop, I'd go into the command post and I'd say, okay, watch the progress of a mission. I'd go talk to people in other sections, mm-hmm, just BSing, just so we would get an idea. Pilots, we were on a first name basis. And it was, we were friends. We maybe weren't at home, you know, we didn't go out of town because we weren't allowed to. But we were friends up there.
Yep.
Sam?
Go ahead.
I think back to the maps. I was called in by the Director of Operations, then Doug Nelson, Colonel, mm-hmm, and was told that I was to go to St. Louis, Missouri, to the agency that made the maps for the Army, Navy, whomever. And I was to tell those, the map people, that we needed a map that could be destroyed in the air and tell us how we could do it. And I left them with some copies of the maps and the frames that we had, what we put the maps on. And about a week or 10 days later, they called me and said, come see what we've got. So I went to see them, and they had a pan with my cardboard outlay with the map on it. And he says, watch. And he takes this black fluid and he pours it in there. And the map went away. So that, I said, that works fine. So I said, we'll be in touch. So I called Lockheed and told them this is what we'd found. And in about two or three weeks, I get a phone call to come over to Lockheed. They're going to pull the test on this soluble map. So this map, I had to set up some of the things in cardboard frames, and there's a little container in the cockpit about so wide, about so high, like that. and the map sat in that and had a lid to it. And they had put this up on a cord, a piece of plywood, the container, some plastic lines going down to this reservoir. When the pilot pulled the ejection handle, that fluid in that container was shot on tremendous pressure into the container and ate up the paper. When I arrived at Lockheed, they had a table set up, wall over there with this thing on the wall, and we're gonna test it. I stood in back of the table, and the Lockheed people sat at the table. And they said, "Are we ready?" And I said, "Yep." And he pulled a switch or something, they exploded the fluid out of that thing, and it shot in that thing again. The only problem was the case top didn't have a lock on it. And when that thing, that pressure with that black fluid in there, it opened up like this. All these guys sitting at the table, they got a little bit of black fluid all over them. And I was in deep trouble with Lockheed because I was on the ground laughing so hard at them dodging the thing. But I found out later on from Al, or was it from Ron Gerard last night, that evidently they did away with that black fluid, and they found that water dissolved that map just as good as that black fluid. So I understood that's what they changed. So when Al was talking about these changes, we never made any changes to the physical aspect of the airplane.
Understood.
What we made changes to was the way that they could have information to fly the mission.
Right.
And there was a lot of those.
Right. So,
I was just gonna add that the reason for these maps was an emergency type. That is, if the film strip broke, if it was unusable, any shape or form,
right.
This was something that the pilot could pull these maps out of the container and use them as an emergency. I mean, it never happened, but it was a backup.
Thanks for explaining that.
Yep.
So you were saying changes to mission. So what sort of walk me through training sortie within the U.S. Like what would be the process of your, you've planned everything and the flight takes off. So then what happens? Where are you? How do you watch? How is the debriefing? What happens?
I think that when I say this, I'm a little bit out of my technical field, and I don't think other one of these guys know this either. But the aircraft was equipped with something called bird watching. Mm-hmm. And that sent back a signal and let people know that the airplane was still flying. And I cannot tell how CIA utilized that to know it, but that plane couldn't be tracked, okay? The information we got back was when we talked with the pilots after the mission.
Yes.
That would tell us whether or not the INS worked properly. It would tell us that the fuel consumption, we would say, like on one of the stamps we had, at this point you should have X gallons of fuel, pounds of fuel left on board, and that could be verified. So when we were sat with the pilots after the mission, we would review what we expected to happen versus what did happen, and we'd make our changes according to it. So it was just a matter of if we told them what we thought, and they found out if it did what we thought it would do, and if it didn't, we changed. But basically, because we started out with the negative approach, it won't do this, let's plan less, we really
yes.
didn't have to do too much adjusting because the planning stage worked, if that makes sense.
Yes, you were conservative in your planning, so
yes.
that, and which sounds like it was a wise thing to be. And it's really striking, you know, someone wrote in regards to the development of the engine, I forget, one of the fellows that's here wrote something that I read, no one born after 1970 can possibly understand. But what's striking here, of course, is that you're working with very minimal kind of things that we're so used to now as far as things being computerized, signals getting back to you, even, you know, all the navigational things that we can do now on cell phones. It's just really striking how much it was
I think the thing that impressed me, not the thing, but one of the things that impressed me was the secrecy that was kept, because in our little command post, we monitored frequencies, not I, but the command post people.
Yes.
Monitored the airliners' frequencies, because we normally took off to the north. When it took off to the north, it crossed the east-west most traveled airline route, Salt Lake City, San Francisco. And every now and then when we would take off, the command post, which tuned in on airline frequencies to listen for such as this, would hear one of the pilots of a commercial plane saying something like, "Holy, look at that," as the plane went by, which immediately prompted a telephone call to the CIA to meet that plane when it landed, that pilot was promised to go to Attu for the rest of his life if he said anything about it.
Yeah.
So secrecy was a big part of this operation, and to my knowledge, it remained pretty secret until it got to Kadena, then the Chinese and the Russians knew pretty much about it.
Right. So you begin with sorties and training sorties in the U.S., you say here. And then talk a little bit about the whole planning for the refueling and that whole, I mean, that's so interesting to me that.
Lockheed gave us a profile of what they thought would take place. In other words, how far back it should be before it, say from 90,000 feet to the bottom down, say at, 30,000 feet. We used those figures as planning, but what we did was make the plane bottom out further back from the tanker than would normally back up in case that figure was incorrect and he would overshoot the tanker. So what we did, we planned a mission that he would be X miles back. They had an equipment in it called the ARC-50, which gave out distance and azimuth. All this was radio silence.
Mm-hmm.
And when it hit a certain position, distance-wise, it would aircraft start its descent. When we found out that the descent ranges that Lockheed predicted were correct or incorrect, we then closed that bottom-out position to an appropriate position.
Mm-hmm.
So we get there. The tanker squadrons were used to refueling, whether it was an A-12 or B-47, a refueling till there was a refueling. The only difference in that refueling is that they had to have special tanks put into the tankers to carry the JP-7 fuel instead of JP-4 fuel. And to my knowledge, that was not a problem. And they could also use those tanks for normal refueling, but when they refueled the Blackbird, it had to have the JP-7 in. So refueling, I don't think, gave much of a problem to anybody. Most of these pilots have refueled many times.
So there's nothing in the design of that particular plane that makes it different than other kinds of planes to refuel?
If you're talking about the planning stage, or amount of time to take on fuel and so forth, I can say I don't think it did.
Yeah.
But as far as the handling of the aircraft, you have to talk to Frank Murray or one of those guys.
Okay.
That's away from us.
How much were you talking back to CIA? What was the communication
I had
there
a contact at CIA that I reported to maybe once every 2 weeks, we'd get on a secure phone and we'd chat what programs we're doing. And we also had a lot of visitors that come, like Colonel Jack Ledford, who ran the CIA portion of what we did. I was quite familiar with, because he would come into the shop and we would talk and update him and so forth. So I knew him rather well. And on occasion, we were called into CIA headquarters to brief some of the staff that was taking place. So they were pretty well informed. And I can only speak for the ones that I spoke to. I'm sure that other people in operations also spoke to those people.
Yeah.
But they were definitely involved and informed of the status, very much so.
Now, Harold, you've been silent for a little while, so is there anything that's been going through your mind that you wanted to add?
It's been hard. No, it's just, it was for me, because I had been involved in aviation in one form or another all my life, literally. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the biggest thing I had ever encountered. It was just mind-blowing. If you just looked at the whole thing, it was mind-blowing. I mean, here was an airplane that would go out and go up to 78,000 feet just to level off the first time and cruise at just under Mach 3 just to save fuel and come back home so hot from aerodynamic heating that they had to put fans under it to blow on the tires so that the heat wouldn't cause the tires to blow out. Mm-hmm. Early they did. We thought it's cannon shots down on the ramp. And to me, that was a fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. The fact that these guys who had to fly it had to be within certain physical limitations because they had to wear full moon suits, full pressure suits, mm-hmm. and be able to operate everything wearing that pressure suit behind a little windshield that was just relatively small and about 2 inches thick. And one of the pilots I was pretty friendly with, Walt Ray, saw a little spot on the inside of the windshield one day and reached up with his moon suit on, and it left the end of his finger. His rubberized finger stuck to the inside of the windshield. It was so hot.
Oh, wow.
So everything, you know, that fascinated me, just absolutely fascinated me. They've had to pipe fuel around the leading edges of the wings, and their airplane was made out of titanium. And no other airplane had ever been made out of titanium. They had to go buy screws and rivets out of titanium. Anyway, and then the chimes all covered in a composition plastic. And then it all get scorching hot just from aerodynamic heating. And to me, that was just really, it just blew my mind, literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I enjoyed working on it, in the flight planning section in particular, because it gave me an insight of where they were going and what they were doing. I always like to know the inside of things.
Harold made mention of the titanium. When Ken Collins bailed out and the aircraft crashed west of the big Salt Lake, Salt Lake City, in a real barren mountain area place, Colonel Horbury directed about a gaggle of people to go up and march through the mountains, picking up every piece of titanium they could get their hands on because it was still so secretive. And I know they loaded trucks of pieces of titanium along flatbeds and so forth to haul back to the ranch so that that material would not be associated with an aircraft.
Yeah.
That was a little exercise that I got assigned the job after we got back at the base to go around to the different departments that had been involved and collecting the cameras or the film that the people had taken, which they weren't supposed to do in the first place. And I had a lot of fights in my head, but they didn't want to give up that film, but they did. But that was quite a little exercise, and Ken Collins, I'd have to tell you more about that than I
know. Now, what happens once you go to Okinawa? Does the crew go, or?
I didn't make Okinawa. You went to Okinawa.
Well, basically, we just flew missions. We were given, the route was transmitted to us. By this time, we actually more or less perfected what we were doing, and so we just transmitted the route, and we made the maps, and we did the same thing there that we did up at the area, that We just planned the mission. Again, we briefed the pilots before the mission. We debriefed, we did the same thing. It was just a continuation of what we've been doing for the previous, in my case, 2 or 3 years up at the site. It was just as usual, mission as usual. To us, now we weren't flying over people or sites that were trying to shoot us out of the sky. We were the guys back on the ground. But we didn't do anything different.
Well, so that by this time you've got your, we've got all the kinks out.
I mean, yeah. It was, to the flight planners, it was another mission. We'd done this 100 times before.
But certainly, so when you're debriefing the pilots, though, on some of these scarier things?
We just debriefed them primarily on what the same thing we would debrief them. We wouldn't debrief them on, what did you see down? Well, if they saw something unusual. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that was the original debriefing of something happened. We'd want to get the information to whomever as soon as possible. But if it was just a regular flight, they didn't run into any problems. All we were interested in, how did the airplane behave?
Right.
Same information. Did we provide you everything you needed? Was there something for the next mission that maybe you need, some modification we had to make? That was it. We'd done it for so many times. That was the whole idea of practicing, that if we did it in practice correctly and we brought that information, that whatever we did to an actual mission, then we were successful.
Yeah.
I think carrying on from that point, the pilot's input of enemy SAM firing, the capability of the jamming equipment, did it work or did it not work? After a while, when they put the Chinese boat on one side of the island and the Russian boat on the other side of the island, it didn't take them very long to know that when we were going to hit Hanoi X minutes after takeoff, if we went up the Gulf, or was going to be X minutes if we went up from South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm repeating stuff because we followed with the SR-71, basically the same type of missions. So I know what took place then, having not been there for the A-12, but for the 71, that they ended up trying to shoot the plane down with just firing gangs of missiles at one time. If they flew a single SAM after it left its, whatever it left on the ground, it became our missile, and it went back to the ground. The Russians, I know, tried to shoot it down, would fly a MiG up as high as it could and fire missiles. Mm-hmm. I knew some of that because I was involved in the command post at SAC headquarters, so I knew of some things that were taking place because we had our planes flying in that area from SAC at that time, so I could read between the lines when I hear of an unknown aircraft, whatever. So that was a game that only the pilots could come back and say that was right. And then the photographic stuff was fantastic, just unreal. That I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. So, like he said, it was routine. And the only thing that would be changed would be what the pilot would see that might help in some other shape or form,
right,
from a defensive standpoint.
Right, right. Now you've said a couple things I wanted to follow up on, Harold. One was you've been flying for most of your life, so you had been in what was the first aircraft that you came in contact with?
Lucky Jenny.
The first aircraft. It was a Jenny. And they were not made by Lockheed, they were made by Curtis.
Whoa.
What's a Jenny?
Oh, my
God. The only operational aircraft mass-produced in World War I was a training plane built by Curtiss called the JN-4, and the JN led to the nickname Jenny.
Uh-huh.
And when the war was over, all wood, fabric covered, and they were the favorite of all the wing walkers and all that sort of thing back in the early movie days. One of the most famous wing walkers came from my part of the country.
Which was where?
And North Carolina.
Okay.
And the first airplane I ever rode in was sitting in my mother's lap. She loved flying. She was a flapper from the 20s.
Wow.
And sitting in my mother's lap in the front seat of a Jenny out of a cow pasture close to Norwood, North Carolina. And and I grew up on a, my mom and dad worked at a cotton mill, and I grew up on a cotton mill village in the late 20s, early 30s. It was strange if you look back at pictures of cotton mill villages or any kind of industrial villages like that in those days. There were no driveways. People didn't have cars. There were no mailboxes because they didn't do mail delivery. But from my front porch, I could see the end of the brand new dirt runway that they had scraped off. And when I got old enough to sneak away from home, that's where I snuck away to, was the airport.
Wow.
So I was an airport bum for a long, long time.
And so you mean it when you say what a distance between that and what you saw?
Oh, yeah. I can remember seeing things like Army A-17s, which was the 30s observation reconnaissance aircraft. And I thought it was the slickest thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And I saw one of the very early P-51s that a fellow landed on our 2,700-foot dirt strip there, and went off the end of it, but fortunately it was shallow grade, so he didn't crack it up. He was out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a former RAF Battle of Britain pilot.
Wow.
American who, when we got in the war, transferred back. And when the war came along, I went down and signed up in the aviation cadet program, just like hundreds of other young men. And was on orders, had finished pre-flight school, and was on orders to go to primary school, to start flying when the Japanese surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
And everything ended and
went
home.
Yeah. Okay, because you said that, and I wanted to know really what that meant, because that's really interesting. Well, I feel like we're just beginning, but we probably should be getting close to wrapping it up, at least for today. I know that we're not nearly doing anything but scratching the surface here, but I just wonder if there some things, some memories or anything that have been stimulated by this, or any points you want to make before we...
Shall I tell them about the briefing of the wives?
The what, please?
The briefing of the wives.
Well, now you have to.
Oh, okay. They,
you just can't say that.
I don't know why, but they decided they were going to brief, in this case, unfortunately, the only the officers' wives, on what we were, not what we were doing, but who we worked for.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's unusual, though, isn't it?
Very unusual. I never understood why. To this day, I don't understand why. But anyway, they had a, they invited the people from our shop, officers, and I forget how many other people were there. There were two other officers in my shop, and I know we were there. And they came, somebody came and said, well, you know, your husband works for the CIA. Which surprised the hell out of me, you know, that they even said it, because we had no idea why we were invited to Sam's house. And so we all listened. I don't know how long we were there, and Sam's wife probably served us cold drinks or whatever.
And charged him.
Pardon? Do I owe you for those? But anyway, then we left. Unfortunately, my wife, after we left, looked her to me and waited until we had left, and she says to me, what's the CIA?
That is a great...
I wasn't, as it turned out, embarrassed.
That's a great story.
But other than that, yeah, there were a lot of things that happened. But as you say, as we talk today, and as we have been talking recently after we found out about, you know, that we were going to be getting together like this, yeah, I think we stirred up memories in each other.
Right. And, I think the most striking thing to me from the outside is really getting a sense, even though there's so much more that I'm curious about, I have to sort of plan what else I have to do today, but that there was this support for the flights, that you really did provide a way for the flights to be successful, in the interaction with the pilots and the mission planning.
We were absolutely dedicated.
Yeah, and that really comes through.
Every man in there was absolutely dedicated to...
To finish your sentence.
To the successful completion.
Yeah.
The safety of the pilot and the successful completion.
Right.
Every man,
right,
without exception.
I have a comment that under certain quarters would not be well received.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been close to my heart for as long as I've been a navigator. The Air Force was founded by pilots. Every bit of credit should go to those people. Absolutely, without any doubt, without any bad feeling, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But as times changed and missions changed, there were more people involved in flying a mission than just the pilots. I told TD, that on the next reunion, I'd like to present the mission plan side of you. It never has been told. And that's why I requested, and he agreed to allow us to come here today, because I just felt that these gents and the other seven people I had working for me and for us, they deserve some credit. That's what I'm glad to see they're getting today.
Right.
And that's my side of the story of why I think we're here today.
Right.
And I think they deserve that recognition. Because that mission absolutely would not have gotten off the ground if we had not participated.
Right.
That's my...
It really comes across to me that especially when you're looking at an aircraft as unprecedented and as you like skipped a couple of generations of aircraft right over them to get this aircraft, so the success actually absolutely depended upon this kind of work that you guys did. Wouldn't have happened otherwise.
I agree.
Yeah. And so that's
totally agree.
Totally enlightened me about that.
I don't think anybody said, let's don't give credit to somebody. I don't think that happened whatsoever.
No.
Don't mean that at all. I just felt, I don't think the step had been taken to show the other side.
Right.
And that's why I think what you're doing here is, at this reunion is very important.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is important historically, because to have a full understanding of it, and it's important in a lot of ways, not just for this particular history, but for sort of understanding the kind of complexity that you're dealing with at this very, very, very high level of technological flight, in this case. What's then required in order to get it off the ground? I mean, that's just a total silly cliche, but you know, to make it be successful is very complicated. So I wish we actually had more time to get into more of the nitty-gritty, but I think that this is a good start, and I thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh, okay. Well, Sam was in a position where he was playing flights.
Mm-hmm.
How can I say it? Never in the history of the Air Force that I know of had there been any planning of supersonic missions as such. There have been afterburning fighters, fighters that turned on the afterburners to fight and to knock down other aircraft, to operate for short periods of time with maximum fuel flow. What you guys did. I'll get it in a minute. What you guys did was to work out a way to plan missions where aircraft flew at supersonic speeds with afterburning thrust, high fuel consumption thrust, for distances of more than 2,000 miles. Is it?
It's okay.
Talked about bank angles of 30 degrees, turning radiuses of 85 miles. People like you just didn't do that before. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that was a comment by Fred White of Lockheed. Thank you very much, because you know whereof you speak. So.
I tried. I was.
I do too. That's a good thing. Because I think what you're expressing really, you're really expressing how really vitally important that work was.
You know, the mission planning was such that if they hadn't had the success in mission planning, to working with the pilots and with us to work out flight plans where you could go many thousands of miles over a track 500 feet wide. Mm-hmm. It's out of this world.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Fred.
Thank you.
Okay, I think that's a really wonderful way to end this, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.